We've been focusing on the broad area of health and spirituality this week in our sessions. And we started off talking about whole person healing and how in our modern times more and more attention is being placed on health promotion and prevention, because there are so many lifestyle diseases now for which people need to assume greater responsibility for their own care. And we've focused particularly on the spiritual dimension of whole person health care. We've talked about the spiritual needs of people and how they are met, and what the church can do in terms of helping people with concerns about health and healing. Now, today our focus is going to be on healthy dying, because dying is a part of every person's life cycle. And though within a medical context, it often feels like failure because medicine has done everything that it can do. And when it can do no more, it appears at least as if it has failed. And medical people tend to treat it that way. I think that's understandable. Hospitals really are for winners. They're for people who get better, and they're not very hospitable for people who are dying. And that's been one of the wonderful things about the hospice movement, which is designed to help people to find a better way to die, what I would call a healthy dying. There are studies that show that nurses are more slow to respond to the buttons or the lights that go on when patients ask for help than they are for other patients, that physicians don't spend as much time with the terminally ill because they've done the best they can, and now there is something else that is needed. When cure is no longer possible, that's when care becomes preeminent in terms of what people need. And so we want to talk some about that. It's been a taboo topic in our culture, much the way that sexuality was for many, many years, something you simply don't talk about. But that's changed in the last 20 or 30 years, particularly through the work of Elizabeth Kübler Ross. She's the one who started it. I find the first part of her book on death and dying in many ways the most interesting part. Her book on death and dying talks about stages of dying, and we might talk more about that later, because it was her way of talking about a healthy dying, going through these stages. But in the first part, she talks about when six students came from Christian Theological Seminary, which is associated with the University of Chicago, and she was at Billings Hospital, which is the teaching hospital of the University of Chicago. And these seminary students came over and said, "We have a group project in which we would like to interview terminally ill patients." Well, she thought that was a good idea. And she said, "Well, I'll try to be of some help to you in arranging that." And lo and behold, she didn't find that there were any dying patients at Billings Hospital. You have to realize that Billings Hospital is a research hospital. It's the hospital where doctors send their patients when they don't know anymore what they can do. And so they have some of the most sophisticated experimental kinds of programs for people who are dying. But when she first started her work, it was the philosophy that you don't talk to people about this because it will just make it worse. You don't want to cause any more trauma than is necessary for these patients. And so there was a conspiracy of silence in medicine for many, many years about dying as something that you don't talk about. Now, you can't blame that on medicine. It was a cultural thing that was pervasive throughout the society. Well, anyway, she pursued this vigorously and finally developed a seminar at Billings Hospital that was centered around interviews with dying patients. She did that in a room where she and the chaplain of the hospital interviewed a person who was dying. And then there would be one of these two-way mirrors. You could see one way, glasses, see one way and not the other. And the students, seminary students, medical students, nursing students, social work students, would watch this interview with the person who was being interviewed knew this was going on. It was not a secret thing. And then afterwards they would talk about it. And Elizabeth Kübler-Ross treated the dying patient as the teacher. Said, "You are our teacher. You're the one who knows about this." And it gave these people an opportunity to not only have somebody listen well to them, but then to have something to give in their dying times. And what she discovered and what is now common knowledge is that people who are dying do want to talk about it. They feel terribly isolated with the conspiracy of silence and with the sort of closed awareness. And that now, in terms of the care of the terminally ill, it's certainly built into the hospice program, that the encouragement for people to talk about this is considered right at the core of the care that you provide them. And I think that's absolutely essential, because it's as people talk that their spiritual needs come out, and there's an opportunity to provide the kind of ministry that is so desperately needed by people who are dying. But we're all dying, you know. It's just that some of us are going to get there a little sooner than others. So it's not too early to start talking about it with each other. I taught a course on understanding death and dying at Valpo, and I always taught it in the spring, and at spring recess, I always told students, some evening, buy a bottle of wine and light a candle and get your parents to sit down and talk about this. And many of them did and came back and said how rewarding it was to talk to their parents for the first time about something that was obviously important and that they had thought about a great deal. Okay, enough of an introduction. I want to start this off with the question is, what is it that people fear in their dying? Because that's, I think, one way to get at what is a healthy dying. A healthy dying is one that finds a way to alleviate and meet what it is that people are afraid of. Esther, maybe you could just keep a list of what we come up with. What What do people fear in dying? When you think about your own dying, what are the fears that come to your mind? Yes.
Separation from your loved ones.
Yes, separation from your loved ones is probably right at the top of the list for many people.
Pain.
When you hear stories about people, particularly with some kinds of cancer, especially bone cancer, the fear of pain is very great.
Fear of the unknown.
Of the unknown. You know, even if you have strong faith and belief in life with God after death, you still know it's not going to be the same. It is going to be unknown, and even if you're going on a journey to some exciting kind of trip, the fear of the unknown in that can that's a common, very natural kind of fear.
I think for a lot of people, dying alone is a fear. But when my friend and I were hiking up to Lyman on Monday, we decided we wouldn't care if we would die alone in these beautiful woods. We would die and let the wolves eat us. I mean, that was fine with us.
Okay. There is a difference, I think, between being alone and being isolated. And there are... isolated means you're cut off from other people, but alone, there are times we like to be alone. Mm-hmm. And I know I've talked to many people who the idea of being by themselves in their dying is not fearsome. In fact, they prefer that, certainly prefer it to be surrounded by all kinds of technicians trying to keep you alive when you're ready to die. But some kind of solitude, that's the word I was looking for, solitude, is not a bad image for dying. What else are people afraid of? Roma?
A major concern that my wife had was that the work that she had immersed herself in so vigorously in the last 15 years was not complete, that there was so much more to do, and that she really regretted that, and she kept saying,
something left undone that you had to do. One of the most powerful stories about dying that I've read, I referred to this week. It's a book by Cornelius Ryan and his wife. It's called A Private Battle. Cornelius Ryan was a famous World War II correspondent. He was in the midst of writing a book that he finished, A Bridge Too Far, about one of the epic battles in World War II. He was in the midst of that, the research on that, when he realized he had a rather fast-growing cancer. He kept a record of that in his own notes, unbeknownst to his wife, of his struggle. And then after he died, his wife took those notes and then told her story along with his about this private battle, and what kept him alive was the need to complete this project, which he did, and it's a magnificent story of an engagement with dying. There's a lot of good stories about that are available. Now, the literature on death and dying is quite extensive now. What else comes to your mind when you think what
fear
I'm afraid
of? Being a burden.
Of being a burden. In fact, if I were to come up with the list, that one is the one that would be high on my list. We're taught from early on to become independent, and we treasure our independence and ability to manage our own lives. And so when we're put into a position of complete dependence, as many are in their dying, it's very hard to receive graciously the care that you need and are deserving of. Most of us are much better at helping others and caring for others than we are in receiving care. And I think that our Christian faith does not help us often as much as it might, because we're taught all the time to care for others, and we're not helped as well in receiving graciously care from others. And when you're dying, you need to be able to do that well. Yes?
For many in our society, it's a fear of medical bills being left behind.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Economic burden. Heavy expense.
Nursing home.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And is it worth it?
Yeah.
And when does one stop the treatment? Because it really is not a cost-benefit thing that is worth it.
And then the whole issue of why can't I die sooner, because I'm going to die anyway, and how can this be stopped?
Yeah. Right. In the back.
Doubts of faith.
Yes. Doubts of faith. Like, could you say a little bit more about that? Like, what might
well,
it be?
Well, you get to the point, if it should be an extended illness, I think there's times when, even though we may have been immersed our lives in a faith relationship, and we thought that we had this all answered, if it's an extended illness, we may begin to lose some of the strong faith that we thought we had, to the point where we begin doubting whether there is anything except pain for us, or anything left out here. At the time of death.
Oh, yeah. Very, very, very good. You know, that happens. Your ability to cope, you become more irritable in your relationship to other people and so forth. And that's bound to be the case also in your relationship to God. You're not a different person in your relationships to others than you are in your relationship to God. So that, again, would be a very natural kind of thing.
Christ said, "Why hast thou forsaken me?"
Yeah.
So he gave. So if you doubt, it was okay to me, because Christ also said that on the cross.
Yeah.
And so then you have to remember.
Good. If he could be and feel forsaken, that's a point of identification. Yeah, very good. You know, it's interesting to be that nobody has mentioned what anybody at the time of Luther would have put up at the very top of the list. What do you think it would have been?
Punishment.
Hell. Not one person has mentioned that.
Our faith must be strong enough that we really believe it.
Well, yes, I think that's true. I really do think it's true. As you grow deep in the faith, that and have a heavy emphasis on the grace and forgiveness of God, that recedes. But Luther had that, and many people of his time did. But the culture in which he lived and the time in which he lived made that fear just much more common than it is today. Went through books of art on the Middle Ages once, just to get some slides on images of death. And I was really struck, not only by the preoccupation with death that we don't have. I mean, we're able to sort of push it in the background and not think about it pretty successfully, because it doesn't surround us all the time. I mean, we're not confronted with it. But if you live during the plague, like the 14th century, where 1/4 to 1/3 of the population was gone over a period of a very short period of time, I mean, you can't get away from it. And the preoccupation with death and the wrath of God associated with death was just very, very, very strong in the whole culture and in the faith of people in a way that's simply not common. Does anybody here have any fear about what will happen to your body after death? Is that a fear anybody has?
I fear it'll be too pampered. I wish it weren't that style of burial that we have.
Yeah. Well, I'll make a personal confession. I always thought that very strongly, that after I'm dead, you know, that body is not me, and what happens to it is not really of any concern, until I was faced with the question, I raised it for myself, do I want to give my body to medical science for dissection? I mean, they need bodies to work on in terms of anatomy. And I discovered I couldn't do that. And I finally figured out why. It's because the body image is so strong. I mean, my image of my body now is very strong. And to expect that that's simply going to be gone, if you think in terms of the future, is maybe not fully realistic, that the body image is part of how you think of yourself. Anyway, I found that was a lot stronger for me than I had realized. And some people who are afraid of flames would not want to be go through that kind of process after death. I had a good Jewish friend of mine who said, I cannot imagine any Jew who would be cremated because of identification of the cremations.
What do you do with the part that you be given a new body?
Well, I believe
you don't need this one.
Well, that's right. Yeah, I believe that up here. I really do. But at some level,
I don't believe what I didn't hear.
I believe that that I'll be given a new body in heaven, and just in the way that St. Paul talks about it in 1 Corinthians 15. But at some level, my identification with this body is still very strong, and to project to the time of my own dying, I cannot just cognitively eliminate that. And I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm just saying it's there. And it becomes part of fear for me at some level. I'm not preoccupied with it, but it's there. Well, anything else on that, on fear of dying? I think it's helpful just to name those things.
I want to mention loss of control.
Mm.
I was talking to a lady this week, and she was telling me about her uncle, that he had surgery, and apparently did fairly well with the surgery, and then it was decided that he needed a second surgery, and he was totally opposed to the second surgery, absolutely opposed. And his wife and the doctor absolutely insisted that he have the surgery. So basically, I guess there was nothing he could do to oppose it. He tried, but didn't get by with his opposition. Went through the surgery, was dead within a week, because he had no say in his future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a big one, I think. Loss of control.
Mm-hmm.
As you move toward
that. My husband was dying. We went to the hospice program, and it was beautiful. But the spiritual advisor, and in this case, I didn't know whether to, they asked, do you want the spiritual advisor to come? And I didn't know, and our pastor had been there, but I said yes, because at that point, this seemed good. And she was wonderful, because she talked about going to fear of the unknown. And she said, for her, death was a lot like hers. That that when a fetus or when a child is going to be born, it comes from a very comfortable environment. It's very well cared for, but it has to face that journey through that birth canal, which is rather horrendous in some cases, and going out into a world where it has no idea what it's going to be cared for as well as it was in the uterus. And she said, for her, death was much the same, that we go from a very comfortable environment where we know where we're being cared for, hopefully, that we come from a caring environment, and then have to go through a very difficult birth canal that we maybe have heard about, but in different ways, but really don't know up here. And then into, again, what we really don't know. I mean, we've been told things, but there are a lot of questions that are unanswered. And for her, the two journeys were very similar. And that was a very comforting kind of thing to think about.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I've never made that connection as closely as that, the analogy of two different kinds of births. Yeah. The early martyrs in the Christian church talked about death as birth. I mean, they used that metaphor regularly to talk about the new beginning and birth into life with God. But that makes it much more specific and concrete to think of it as moving through a very narrow canal, the gates of death, mm-hmm. and knowing that you go through by yourself. I mean, you can be accompanied with all the loving care in the world up to that point, but at that point you move by yourself, except, of course, if you have the faith that St. Paul speaks of, that there is nothing, finally, death, life, principalities, powers, whatever you want to name in terms of terrors, that can separate us from the love of God in Christ. So you can say that Christ goes with you through there, but still terrifying to think
about. My husband died of lung cancer and bone cancer, and his peace as he died, I'm not afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And they said he may become unconscious, maybe a whole day or two, three. He never did. And within hours of his death, he kept saying, I don't have much time now. Now, there was something that he knew, but I wanted to say something like, how do you know? But I couldn't. I didn't want to interrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And make it hard.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
But he just... My sister lost in his fight. He just slipped into the arms of God.
In a very beautiful way.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I felt, because when he saw that he didn't have much time, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And he knew that. He didn't struggle or try to make it different.
Uh-huh.
But so, to me, that's what death is.
Yes.
See, it is a different, and I like what she said about the birth, because it is a different thing that you don't know.
Uh-huh.
And I wish I had the answer, because you always think, well, you know, a little more, you know, by saying to him that. But it was a peaceful going.
Uh-huh.
And not everybody, they tell me, does that.
Uh-huh.
But I thought, because he assured me, I believe in Jesus. And I needed to know that.
Yes, yes.
And he said it three times. And then my friend who had lost her husband in April, she sent me a doubt, and it says, I believe, I believe, I believe. And I have it on a magnet thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave me the comfort of knowing that he truly believed, and then it was so peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, to me, it's peace because he was in such pain.
Yes. Yeah, you have been blessed with that.
That was a good
yes, it surely was.
I think I can't think of what I got.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the topic is healthy dying, and that's as good a story for talking about healthy dying as I've heard anywhere. Thank you for that. It's and there are other stories like that. Somebody referred earlier this week to people who talk about near-death experience.